You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the National League West. Things are getting down to the nitty-gritty as we are around under 20 games left in the season. There's still quite a nice little race going on in the NL West between the Dodgers and the Giants. The Dodgers have maintained a decent lead, but with six games remaining between these two teams, anything can happen. So things can swing one way or another, or they might stay status quo. But with both fighting for a playoff spot, I think we're going to see both in October. But, of course, it's getting very interesting. And as we've predicted all year, it might just come down to the last weekend of the season, which would be very good for baseball. So we'll just have to stay tuned on what happens with the Dodgers and the Giants. I'm joined by my colleague Ken Gernick, who covers the Dodgers for MLB.com. And I guess we kind of have to start with what everybody's sort of been talking about recently, which is that goofy three-error play that the Dodgers experienced against the Padres on Monday. These are the kinds of things that are really, really funny when you're up by six, and then when it's over, you're still up by four. So mostly I saw from what I was reading, people were basically laughing it off. These are also things that if it happens to a team like the Brewers or somebody who's watching their season get flushed down the toilet, these things wouldn't be so funny. So, Ken, what were you thinking when this whole thing was going on and watching this unfold and sort of the team's reaction when it was over?
Well, the Dodgers have had history in recent years of being pretty sloppy defensively. They've actually played better this year in the second half. And as Don Mattingly said, they actually played a really good game last night, except for that one play. So it was great for the highlight reels. You know, it has no meaning in the race. But, you know, if you're looking for a good laugh, then watch it several times. You know, but the Dodgers spent a lot more time last night talking about Clayton Kershaw's 18th win and the fact that they added a half game onto their lead and got a little closer to clinching. So I think that might have been a little more important in the clubhouse, but I know from the fans' view, it was funny to watch.
Yeah, I mean, there's things that you don't see every day. And, you know, sometimes they just happen. And, again, I mean, because the team's doing so well. And just some of the things I'm reading, it seems like Don Mattingly, I mean, he's always very even-keeled and he's not ever going to, you know, win the award for the most excitable manager in baseball. Seems to be just very steady when he's talking to the media and very steady when he's in the dugout. He's been in a kind of a good mood lately. Do you get that impression from him that he's, you know, feeling pretty good about where the team is right now and, just, you know, where they're kind of settling in as the stretch run continues?
Well, yeah, and even on that play, you know, he cited the fact that even though all these throws went wild, the guys were in the right position to back up to make those throws. And maybe earlier in the year and in previous seasons, they wouldn't even have been backing up properly. So he does feel that they're playing sharper, crisper. They're doing the right things. For the most part, they're throwing to the right bases, and they're not beating themselves, you know, except on that one isolated play. They've played pretty clean lately, and you know, not beating yourself is a key to not only winning a division, but in the postseason, those mistakes seem to be magnified. And so he's looking for his club to sharpen its game. And for the last month or so, he feels they have, especially now that they've gotten back most of their injured players.
Yeah, and that's pretty good timing. I was reading an interesting article that you had on the Dodgers website, just sort of what's going on with the relief staff. Two emerging relievers that are making a case for not only getting quite a bit of playing time, but you might see them in some pretty crucial situations, Carlos Frias and Pedro Baez. So they might even see themselves sharing some time with some, or maybe even taking a few innings away from some of the more familiar names that we've seen. How is that? How do you see that sort of shaking out? And is that just to continue through the regular season, or are these guys also candidates to be on the postseason roster? Forgive me for not knowing all of that.
Well, you know, Mattingly seems to be pretty loyal to his veterans through July. Come August, he seems to want to go with the hot hand, and I think he learned that from Joe Torre, if he didn't already know that from his playing days. And at that point, it's about winning and not hurting feelings. You can't worry about that. So, you know, whether it means that Andre Ethier goes to the bench or even Yasiel Puig goes to the bench, he's not producing and he hasn't been, you know, that's what he'll do. He put in Joc Pederson, who hadn't played a minute in the major leagues, and he gave him three or four starts. And so the same thing has happened in the bullpen in that in the seventh and eighth inning, Mattingly's been struggling to find the right setup combination to get to Kenley Jansen. And, you know, lo and behold, he calls up a couple of these hard-throwing kids in Pedro Baez and Carlos Frias. And what he has mentioned that he likes about them, in addition to the fact that they're now throwing strikes, which you can't always count on from rookies, but they have live arms. So they can overcome a mistake, a mislocated pitch. If it's going 97 miles an hour, it's still hard to catch up to. He's got Brian Wilson and J.P. Howell. They've been setting up lately, and they can't overcome a mislocated pitch. They just don't throw hard enough. So those other two rookies have kind of worked their way into some important innings. And you've got a bullpen that's had a disappointment in Chris Perez and disappointment in Brandon League. And so the rookies are finding their way into these games down the stretch and very well could find their way onto the postseason roster.
Some of those guys, I mean, really, they end up being these huge keys in the postseason, like people that you weren't even talking about 2 months ago or 1 month ago. I mean, we've seen that happen a lot before, where especially from the pitching standpoint, just not having so much mileage on the arms, I would think, can really pay dividends in the postseason, and having not had so much stress, not only mileage like over long periods of time, but even just over one season. And so you get some of these young kids in, and if I guess that they can handle sort of a postseason pressure, and maybe being sort of clueless might help even a little bit when you come to an environment like that in October.
Right, and I think you also have to consider the opponents in this. I think when a batter hasn't seen a pitcher, it gives a pitcher a slight advantage. I know it could work the other way around, but I think in situations that you're talking about, maybe a guy has a funky delivery, he's deceptive, he hides the ball, whatever it is, if a hitter hasn't, you know, you can hear about scouting reports and watch video, but until you're standing in the box, you have to watch that ball react, see where it comes from. You just can't duplicate that. I think sometimes these call-up pitchers kind of catch the hitters a little bit off balance and by surprise. So I think you might be seeing some of that right now, too.
Well, it'll be interesting. And let's talk just briefly on Josh Beckett, who needs surgery to repair his labrum, which I think we all knew, and for months and months of rehab. He's mulling retirement, and he seems to be pretty open about this, too, as far as talking about this. And what's amazing about Beckett is he's only 34 years old, but he started his major league career when he was 21. I remember when he was just that little baby-faced kid and making his debut in 2001. But over 2,000 innings pitched, 13 seasons. I mean, there's a lot of mileage on that arm. So it's looking kind of bleak for him from what he says and the extent of what this surgery would be. So I guess it's not that shocking that he's really sort of accepting that retirement might be something that he has to do.
Yeah, he almost sounds, I don't know if eager would be the right word, but he doesn't seem to be fearing retirement. You know, along with all those innings, he's got a lot of money in the bank, too. Made a lot of money over his career. He doesn't need to play. And not that he doesn't enjoy the competition. I think he still does. But he doesn't enjoy the fact that his body's breaking down. And once it starts, sometimes there's no stopping it, and I think that's what he's looking at. And with that comes, you know, hours and weeks and months of rehab, and that can get old. And I think sometimes, you know, when you have a young family and you got $100 million in the bank, the thought of another operation and another 3 or 4 months of rehab just isn't real appealing, and it doesn't seem to be to him. So I think he's already decided he's not coming back. He hasn't announced it. He's leaving himself a little wiggle room, but I think the Dodgers are proceeding as if he won't be back. And his tone sounds like he's accepted the fact that he won't be back. So, you know, he's had a great career. He's done a little bit of everything, and it was you know, especially nice coming off the surgery that he had last year, missed almost the entire season. He was able to come back, pitch well in April and May when Clayton Kershaw wasn't in the rotation, and also when Ryu went out on the disabled list. He delivered some big starts for them. He was only 6-6, but his ERA was under 3, and he was able to throw a no-hitter and add that to his resume. So he's had a great career. He had a really good first half. It's just unfortunate ending that he wasn't able to finish it off.
It's amazing because I find that whole thing just fascinating, just players after retirement, you know, what they have to go through. And like you said, I mean, he's got so much money in the bank, he doesn't need to be pitching. But at the same time, like, he's going to be looking at being 35 years old and having to occupy a lot of his time between now and 40 years from now, you know, 45 years from now. And so, I mean, you've been around this game for a long time, and I'm sure you've talked to a lot of former players. That's a tough thing, the tough transition as they, you know, for a year it's great, and maybe even two for a guy that's got to overcome, you know, pain and injury. But after that, they sort of have to figure out what to do, and there's no really easy answer. I mean, there's broadcasting, there's coaching, but it's a tough thing for somebody to go through.
Well, especially if their whole – you know, personality in life is revolved around their success as an athlete. You know, more well-rounded people who have other interests, hobbies, family, and, you know, they seem to make that transition a little easier. Some of them already have an idea what they want to do before they're done, whether it's coaching, whether it's running a business. You know, some go into the union and they want to represent players as agents. There's a lot of different spin-off careers they could do, and a lot of them start thinking about that before their time is over. But then you have some guys that were superstars and just they know they don't ever have to work again. And I know we all would love to have that problem, figuring out what to do with the rest of your life when you have more money than you can spend. But as you say, you know, for some of them, there is a psychological hurdle to clear. And they have to feel like they're doing something of value. And I'm sure that, you know, Josh is a smart guy, and he'll figure out something. I know he does want to spend some time with his family. He's got some young kids, and that should be a priority too.
Yes, absolutely, and he'll enjoy it for a while, and then we'll keep our eye on what's going on there. So, Ken Skernick, thank you so much. It was a good conversation. Appreciate your time. I am joined in a second by my colleague Chris Haft, who covers the Giants for MLB.com. And as we are looking toward the last couple of weeks of the regular season, the Dodgers and Giants, of course, are locked at the top of the division and trying to win it. And while the Giants are really within a stone's throw of taking over the division lead, they're also trying to fight off quite a few teams that are trying to catch them in the wild card race. So as we all know, with the new format, it's a lot easier to keep playing in October late if you are not the wild card team. So this could be a very interesting race to the finish. And let's bring in Chris. I liked your rundown on 9 things I could factor into what happens with the Giants, kind of a make or break time for them right now. And I guess the really cool thing, I mean, for fans that are sort of watching this from the outside and are not living and dying with every single game, is the fact that these two teams are going to play each other 6 times. And so a lot could happen. I mean, the Dodgers right now are in first place, but that could change on a dime if the Giants have to go on some kind of tear when they meet up with the Dodgers.
Allison, you're absolutely right. That's why these guys aren't, corny or whatever as it may sound. They're not giving up. They would have to win, of course, probably 4 of those 6 games against the Dodgers, maybe even 5, you know, to really make a dent in the Dodgers lead, and at least, and to do it, you know, without requiring help from other teams. And even then, they'd need a little bit of help. But and of course, they probably have to. That means they probably have to beat Clayton Kershaw twice, at least once, because he'll pitch in this weekend series here. I'm not sure about the series down there, but. Beating Clayton Kershaw twice in the space of 10 days. I don't know, but they're going to try. And at least, as you mentioned, they do have the wild card to fall back on. Of course, they'd rather not have to fall back. As a couple of players said to me, you know, we're not in this to finish 5th, but you know, that's the way the playoff system, the postseason system has developed. And it's better than nothing as far as they're concerned.
It's funny to just when Kershaw pitches, and like in his last start, he gave up his first hit, like in the third or fourth inning, and the stadium all groaned, like thinking, oh, shoot, we're not going to see a no-hitter. That's crazy that every time he takes them out, there's like a really, really good chance that you might be seeing some history base. So I guess trying to beat him twice, I mean, it does sound a little bit funny at this point that it would even happen, even though stranger things have happened, I guess.
Oh, it's so far-fetched. But, you know, they've beaten them in the past. It's usually low-scoring games, you know, obviously. I think the only time I've ever seen Clayton Kershaw get, you know, downright pummeled was the final game with the NLCS last year. I mean, otherwise, he's, either he loses, it's 2-1 or 1-0, or he'll get a no decision, you know, 7 innings, 2 runs or something like that. So, the Giants did win a game against L.A. that he started earlier this year, and they were successful in the way they succeeded against them was working the count, taking a lot of pitches, trying to be patient. And that's fine and dandy, except so often, of course, he gets you to play his game. That's the thing. But, I mean, I imagine they'll revert back to that May strategy, you know, when they do face him here in the next, you know, this weekend and maybe the week after.
Yeah, it's funny because from, like, the outsiders such as myself and other people that are not in San Francisco watching the Giants play, we look at AT&T Park as, like, this, like, amazing – I mean, it is an amazing ballpark, this great atmosphere, beautiful setting. But the Giants just thrive, and they love to play there, and all these wonderful things happen. And as you pointed out, they were terrible at home for 2 months. I mean, this wasn't, like, some small sampling. So they lost 22 of 29 games at home for over 2 months. And now they've kind of righted that ship a little bit. So was that baffling? I mean, I know we talked about it a long time ago, but when you look back on that, just because of how much that ballpark really does work to the Giants' advantage in so many factors, but besides, mostly because just the crowds are amazing and they're in it from, you know, till the very last out, and that has to give them a boost. But to look back on that, it's not surprising now that they've kind of figured it out, but that it lasted that long.
Yeah, well, you know, as you almost positive factors you point out about the park, they are indeed valid. The thing is, a lot of hitters hate hitting here. And, I don't know if hate's too strong a word, but it gets inside some of these guys' heads. You know, they'll hit one well to left center or right center, and it ends up in somebody's glove, or they get a double out of it where they feel like they should have gotten a home run. So I think maybe that attitude for the guys on this team who don't like or who would find playing here a challenge, I think that attitude kind of crested, if you will, during that 22 losses in 29 game space. But now that they've started to win a few more, I think people are being a little more positive about the whole experience. And you know what? My feeling is, I know I've never played professional ball, of course, but my feeling is if you can't hit a home run, take the double. You know,
right. Yeah. I think that when you look at the team as a whole and how well they've been playing lately, I mean, Buster Posey, it's not surprising that his numbers that he's been producing lately are pretty much coinciding with the Giants starting to win some games. He's been just ridiculous, off the charts ridiculous in the last couple of weeks, which is kind of what this team needs. I mean, they have to have Buster, but they don't need him hitting .493, which I'm assuming we'll probably even out, you know, eventually. But he's one of the guys, he's one of the two that I really want to talk about, Buster Posey being the one that you depend on, that this team, like, has to have, putting up these great numbers. Then Angel Pagan is a guy who doesn't attract a lot of attention, but when you take him out of the equation, as they had to when he was hurt, that's when things started falling apart. So those two are, like, kind of on opposite sides, yet their contributions are just vital to this team.
Yeah, Allison, as you know, every team needs its big guys down the stretch particularly, and Buster's coming through at the right time for them. It's remarkable how his numbers the last few weeks mirror the numbers that he put up during the second half of the year in 2012 when he won the National League MVP award. In fact, I think he's probably snuck onto the ballots of a few MVP voters, maybe not necessarily in number one, but you know, certainly in the top 10, and I think he'll get some support there in the MVP balloting. But they're gonna continue to need him here these last 2 weeks or so. Angel Pagan, the Giants learned last year exactly how much he meant to the offense when they missed him for 80-some games with a hamstring after undergoing hamstring surgery. Instantly, when he came back, even though they were already out of it by then, the offense started to click. And so that's another guy who is going to have to come through for them. The thing is about this lineup, it is deep, deeper than maybe a lot of the lineups they've had in the past. They still have, you talk about Posey and Pagan, but there's also Buster Pence, Pablo Sandoval, and rookie Joe Panik at second base has been a real find. So their offense is pretty healthy right now.
Now, when you look at Tim Hudson, I just think he's such a great story. Obviously, I didn't realize he's never had a sub 500 season in his entire career, which is just remarkable. And it might be headed there this year. He's a game under 500 right now, but just his steady hand and his experience. I mean, anybody who's been around him understands why he's a leader. Regardless of where he goes. And he can be a really vital kind of anchor in that clubhouse, I would think, this time of year.
He can, and he's so consistent. He's so even-keeled in his demeanor, and he's consistent and even-keeled on the mound. No matter what his one-loss record is, I think if you looked at the team's record in his starts, which, frankly, I don't know offhand, but I'm pretty darn sure it's over 500. Over the years, he's had a lot of no decisions. I actually covered him for one season with the A's in 2004. And I remember a conversation I had with him early in spring training. He just kind of shrugged off his bad luck about not getting more wins and getting a lot of no decisions. But just about all those no decisions were games that the Athletics won. So he wasn't, he didn't feel remorseful or regretful about that at all.
Well, I would say that, just looking at the schedules of all the teams and going, it's going to go down to the last weekend. I mean, how can it not, right? And I still think, I don't know, I still have a feeling that the Giants are going to be clawing and scratching to try to win that division. But I think they probably have to feel pretty confident at this point that a postseason berth is more likely to happen than it is. I mean, there's a lot of teams right now that are that have been, in cruise control and have absolutely been at the top of the standing somewhere and are just completely falling apart right now. And you can kind of feel like the A's and the Brewers, you can kind of feel that they're just, like, clenched really tightly. I think that the Giants sort of feel differently. They're like, okay, good, things are coming together right at the right time, and, we're feeling good, and we seem to be healthy. Is that kind of the impression that you get?
Yes, but they're not overconfident. They're not overconfident. They are, however, extremely, poised and positive when they go out there. But as people know, Bruce Bochy, their manager, as a lot of people know, Bruce Bochy, their manager, isn't going to let them get overconfident. Bochy's been around. He's been around 10 winners, and of course, he managed them to their two World Series in 2010 and 2012. When they had to come from behind, 2010. Came from behind in the regular season to win the division and reach the postseason. 2012, they came from behind in both the division series and LCS to win those series and advance to the World Series. So they know that if they can do it, other teams are capable of all of a sudden gelling and jamming the accelerator and passing them up. So they're not going to – I don't see this team giving up or lightening up or easing up at all until they've clinched something.
Yeah. I think everybody kind of looks at them as the little engine that could, even though they always have parts missing to seem to get to put it all together by the end. So we will keep our eye on it. And thanks, Chris. We'll talk to you next week. I am joined by my colleague, Corey Brock, who covers the Padres for MLB.com. And although we've had some high hopes and some realistic hopes for the Padres the last month or so, we have to look realistically at what's going on now. And what is going on now is that nobody seems to be hitting the ball very much. So where has all the offense gone? And for that, I will turn to you, Corey, because obviously you're around this team so much. So are they running out of gas, or are they hitting a wall, or is this just kind of what has been going on with the Padres for a while? Their bats just seem to have gone a little cold.
Yeah, I think this may be kind of what they always were, gone through stretches maybe where they were a little energized and maybe a little breath of fresh air once, you know, they made some deals at the trade deadline. And that's, you know, and that's not indicative of any of the guys that they traded away. But, you know, they brought in some guys who were fired up for maybe a new opportunity, looking to prove themselves. And, you know, and just looking at the roster now with, you know, having traded away Chase Headley, Carlos Quinton on the disabled list, Yonder Alonso, Everett Cabrera, key guys who they, you know, were really counting on to be everyday fixtures in this lineup that, you know, for one reason or another are not a part of this group anymore. And looking at the everyday roster now and really, you know, kind of a composition of it really is a lot of platoon guys, a lot of guys who maybe in other years would be playing in AAA. So it's kind of a tough mix right now. And I think we talked about this before. I'd be really curious to look at what the, you know, the composition of the position player grouping is now compared to what it will be on opening day in 2015. And I think it'll look dramatically different. So, yeah, it's been a struggle for them to score runs. It has been all year, really. They've been shut out 18 times. It's been tough. The pitching's been very good, and a reason why they've been able to stay, you know, within 10 games of 500. They've gotten within five or six a couple different times. And that's really a credit to the pitching staff and, of course, the coaching staff and the manager. But, yeah, again, well, once again, this has kind of been a recurrent theme for the Padres, at least in my 8 years at offense, very hard to come by.
It's interesting because that 6 months of the baseball season, there's a lot of people I think don't quite understand how intensive that can be for guys who have never gone through a 6 months of the baseball season or have played sporadically, minor league seasons being 5 months. And it takes a lot more than, I mean, these guys make it look really easy. I've always said that they make baseball look really easy. It's really hard, and it's very, very tough on the body. And to do it 142 times as opposed to 162 times, there's a big difference. And so when you get some of these younger teams, that can be an issue. And I guess that's kind of a balancing act for the manager to figure out, you know, how to keep everybody relatively fresh going into that last month and be able to figure out who to play when and who not to be playing in September.
Well, and the other thing is, yeah, you have a segment of guys who end up on the disabled list because they can't play. But then you have probably an even larger segment of players who can play but really aren't 100%. And I don't think there's probably any player in that clubhouse, not just the Padres, but, you know, across the landscape of baseball who, by the time you reach the 1st of September, truly feels 100%. I think the toll of 6 weeks of spring training and, you know, 5.5 months of or whatever of the regular season really take their toll. This is, you know, you hear people talk about the everyday grind of baseball, but, you know, I think grind is truly an appropriate word. It's a physically demanding game, not just in the sense of, you know, we're not talking football here, I get it, but just like the daily preparation that goes into getting yourself ready to play a big league game and then turning around and doing it 24 hours, sometimes even less later, coming right back to do it all over again. It's an awful lot. This is 162 games is a lot, and you throw spring training on top of that, and it's a challenge. It's a challenge for a player. It's a challenge for a manager trying to figure out who's available, who's ready to go, dealing with matchups, and then, of course, talking about the Padres when you're dealing with injuries, and also talking about a position player set that's mostly platoon guys and trying to figure out how it all works on a night-to-night basis. That's not very easy to do.
No, and I would also add my little commentary that teams are not granting enough day games on travel days anymore. I mean, you still have them, but it's not like it was even 10 years ago. It just seems like because the gate is better for night games, they have to, you know, they don't have these day games in the middle of the week, and that can take its toll on players, and there has to be some sort of give, I think, on the side of the teams to, you know, if you want your players to still be able to walk upright in the last 2 weeks of the season, then maybe make it a little easier on them during the season. But let's move on. I found this interesting that the Padres have a practice in the last few years of bringing up a minor league player who's not actually going to play in any major league game in September, and just to give him a little taste of big league life, give him a locker in the clubhouse and, you know, throw bullpens in front of the coaches and things like that, but not actually a play. So Matt Whistler seems to be the guy that they're doing that with this year. Is that something that they've done every year, or is this just, you know, when they see somebody that they really want to give this exposure to, they do this?
Yeah, they did that a few years ago with a couple guys they obtained at the trade deadline, and with Casey Kelly, who at the time was one of their top prospects, and kind of a way to, for the Padres, at least in that instance, Allison, kind of selfishly, they hadn't seen any of those three guys at the time because of the timing, and they hadn't seen any of them before, so they got a chance to watch them throw bullpens. Now, they have a deeper history with Matt Whistler because he's been in their system. He pitched in spring training. They're very familiar with him. This is a guy that has a chance probably to make the major league rotation next spring. There was talk of maybe bringing him up in September and letting him pitch a little, but, you know, he didn't need to be added to the roster. He didn't need to be protected this winter. He was fine innings-wise, so there was really no need to squeeze any more innings out of him. But, you know, bring him up, let him be part of the big league clubhouse, have him sit in on pitchers' meetings, have him sit in with the catchers, have him watch the game from the dugout, have him talk to guys during the game. You know, the Padres feel like there's a real value in that. And obviously, you know, he'll throw a few bullpens while he's up here as well. And he won't stay the entire month. He'll go back to Ohio here before too long, and where he'll, you know, shut it down and then before ramping back up with his workouts to get ready for next season. So, but, you know, he's a bright kid, and they feel like, you know, this is a chance for him to sort of get acclimated to the big league clubhouse, a little bit of the travel, what goes into it, and maybe, you know, if and when he, and they, I think they feel like it's when, not if, he becomes part of their big league rotation, there won't be as many surprises for him during his rookie season.
Makes perfect sense to me. It's kind of, you wonder if other teams will maybe start doing that. I found this kind of interesting reading your coverage, Corey Spangenberg, and no, I'm not bringing him up just so I can say his name correctly, but he's had some concussion problems in the past, and concussions obviously being kind of a hot topic, not only in baseball, but throughout major sports. But he has, after sustaining two of them, and he's just now starting his major league career, so that's a little bit scary, but he does specific things to avoid them, and one being wearing a mouth guard, the other vowing to never again slide headfirst into a base. I wish that every player would know not to do that, but you can't. Sometimes you can't fight instincts. But he seems to be taking this seriously and realizes that you can't just keep sustaining concussions if you want to have this quality of life later on in life. So what do you think about all that when he was talking about that?
Yeah, and I think that it's a it makes sense, and he I think it really resonates home with a guy like that, just having gone through the experience of during the past two seasons losing major chunks of his year to the concussion issue, and the Padres certainly have been very protective of him, not just because he's a, you know, a high draft pick, but because you know he's one of their own, and they care about him, and they're not going to rush a guy back, but he sees the value in taking care of himself, and probably realizes that what an awful feeling that was going through that, and, you know, certainly understanding that the more of these you get, the real fine line you start walking as far as are you in a position where you're susceptible to more of these once one happens, once two happens, taking care of your body a little bit better. And then, of course, future studies, what happens in 10, 15, 20 years. So it's a scary thing, and it's a fine line an athlete walks, even in baseball where we don't view this as a contact sport. Now, his second one that he got this year was when he took a knee to the head, sliding head first. But the first one, Allison, you know, he was just playing catch, and he got hit in the head with a ball. So, I mean, you know, these things can happen randomly. So, you know, and I think he's very wary of, you know, what can happen down the road. So he's trying to take every precaution and trying to be as safe as possible. He wants to be in the big leagues for a long time, and he's given the Padres and their fans a nice little sampling on a short look of what he could potentially do. So, trying to take good care of himself and understanding that, you know, you could pay lip service to this all you want, I guess, Allison, but once you kind of walk in his shoes, and now that he's done it twice, he certainly understands how serious this is.
Yeah, I mean, they can't, the 23-year-old, 27-year-old, they can't picture themselves as 40. They can't picture themselves as 45. They can't picture themselves not playing this game professionally. But the reality is that once they're done playing, they have more than half their life left to do something else. And you certainly don't want some of these things that you see happening to football players. The mouth guard, I mean, and I don't, obviously, I don't know a lot about concussions, but how does that, what is that, in terms of protecting him, how does that work? Do you know?
Yeah, I'm a little unclear on that. I think it just kind of helps, it kind of just helps hold the jaw in place and any kind of riveting or kind of, you know, kind of jarring action that could potentially trigger, or it would, you know, start a concussion or like, or at least the mouth guard could help alleviate the chance of that. I'm certainly not a neurosurgeon, but I think it just it gives him a little extra protection in the case that he runs upon something like this, or he, you know, happens to take it. Even if he slides feet first, let's say, there's a whole lot of weird things that can happen around the bag where he could still get hit in the head. But maybe, you know, he wearing the helmet and having the mouth guard, that gives him just a little extra bit of protection that will help him.
Mm. Well, I'm all for that. And Corey, thank you so much. I'm looking at the standings here, and I see that the Padres are pretty much got third place locked down. I don't know what that means, if there's any happiness in that. But you have to look at the positives. So you're not going to end up in fourth place, which is always good. So we will discuss this next week, and we'll see where they are, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
Third place or bust, Allison.
Thanks, Corey. I am joined by my colleague, Steve Gilbert, who covers the Diamondbacks for MLB.com. And as I was preparing for this conversation, I thought, oh, my God, what are we going to talk about? There's absolutely nothing going on with this team. It's going to be 12 minutes of straight silence because it's boring and there's absolutely nothing doing. I'm totally kidding. There's so much going on. The Diamondbacks need a general manager. And while my vote personally is for Hal Morris because he played for the 1990 Cincinnati Reds, I'm guessing that there will be more that goes into the search than just that. So, Steve, give us some insight as to what's going to happen in the next few weeks. I've been reading a list of people, and I'm wondering who isn't going to be interviewed for this job. Seems like a lot of people are up for it. So how do you see this whole thing going? Is this going to be a long, drawn-out process, or is Tony La Russa going to get this wrapped up quickly?
Well, they're moving pretty quick these first few days. From some of the reports, he's already talked. The Cardinals director of player development. He's with Tim Papura, the former GM of the Astros. He's ready to talk with Dave Stewart. So, I mean, he's moving relatively quickly. I think what's kind of interesting, and he pointed this out in a call that we had with him, is that this is obviously his first time doing anything like this. So whatever you're used to being in a GM search, you might not see it with this one because he's just doing it the way he wants to, not necessarily the way it's always been done. And, you know, there's nine candidates, but he emphasized that there might not be nine interviews. There might be some of these candidates, which he wasn't specific as to which ones. The ones maybe less familiar with that he had gotten recommendations on, maybe he was just going to have a conversation with those people to see if it should lead to an interview. So it's going to be kind of fascinating to watch this process plays out. He's got nine names, and they're very diverse, very different backgrounds, and so it's going to give him a pretty good cross-section. It's going to be interesting to see what direction he ends up going because there's depending on who he chooses, there's all kinds of different directions that's kind of saying he wants to take the organization.
Dave Stewart is really interesting. I think that got a lot of people's attention. He's getting a lot of ink just because it seemed like totally out of the box. He's currently an agent. He'd have to, of course, forfeit all of those duties if he's going to be the general manager. La Russa really sees a lot in him, a lot of the qualities in him that would make a good GM, but with just really no experience doing that. So what did you think when you heard his name emerge? He was like one of the first, too.
Yeah, you know, I was one of the first to kind of float his name, and a couple people, you know, immediately kind of shot it down, saying, well, he's an agent, he's a successful agent, why would he want to do that? But he apparently is interested. He has had conversations with Tony, and Tony, you know, likes working with people that he's comfortable with and has a history with and knows very well, and certainly Stewart fits into that category. I think what also has impressed Tony is that, you know, Dave has a, you know, very varied background, I guess you could say. He was obviously an outstanding pitcher. He also served as a pitching coach. He also was an assistant general manager in Toronto for a few years, and now a player agent. So he's kind of seen all different sides of things. He hasn't, you know, I think you like to point out, he's gotten a lot of ink because back maybe in the early 2000s, he was a GM candidate, or his name would get brought up when GM jobs would come open, but not so much since he got into the player agent business. So it's going to be, again, that's a fascinating name, and I think it's somebody who's got to be considered, you know, one of the front runners, just given his relationship with Tony and the way Tony speaks about him.
Now, with Kevin Towers, so he's staying on. Let me make sure I get this right. He's staying on and help out until a new GM is in place, and he's had a job offer, a different position in the organization, which he also says he's going to just kind of hold off and decide later. Everyone is assuming that is he'll wait and see who the actual general manager is. So is that strange, uncomfortable? Is that a normal transition that happen? I mean, sometimes, you know, in my experience, when a general manager gets fired, he's gone and we never hear from them again. But this seems to be a little bit of a different dynamic.
A slightly different dynamic because, yeah, he is going to hang around. They hope to have a GM in place in the next couple of weeks. You know, they're hoping to get it done before the end of the season, it sounds like. That's at least a tentative timeline. So it's not going to be a super long time that he's kind of, you know, watching over things. And at this time of year, there's not a ton of decisions, big-time decisions that have to be made as far as trades or obviously free agent signings, et cetera, et cetera. So on that standpoint, it makes sense. As far as the new GM, he wants to make sure that the new GM would be comfortable with him in whatever role it might be. Tony kind of floated the idea of him being in charge of pro scouting and kind of heading up that department and beefing up that department a little bit. It's kind of the same as when Kevin Towers took over for Jerry DePoto, who was the interim GM towards the end of the 2010 season. He asked Jerry to stay on. Jerry and KT spent some time together to just kind of – Jerry wanted to see if that was going to be a match, if they were going to be able to coexist, and if what kinds of things KT wanted him to do. And he eventually ended up staying for a year before getting the Angels job. So it's not out of the question that KT could end up staying around. It's also not out of the question that it could be a GM he's not comfortable with or a role he's not comfortable with, and he could go be a special assistant someplace else.
He and Tony go back quite a ways. I mean, it seems like they had a nice friendship before any of this started, too. It's a funny business we work in because it just seems like that would be such a bizarre thing, even though it happens quite often that friends are firing friends. General managers fire managers, and they have personal friendships often. And, you know, sometimes this stuff just happens, but it seems like there is a lot of respect with everybody. And there's an understanding, and it doesn't seem like anybody's being, you know, played, or I don't know what the correct word is for that, but it does seem like there's an open dialogue and that everybody's sort of on the same page at least.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting when Tony was first hired, a lot of people thought that was going to be like, you know, KT was immediately going to be gone or gone soon thereafter or was going to be very upset about it. Well, I'm sure he wasn't, you know, obviously thrilled about having somebody brought in above him. He was actually, you know, really, what's the word I'm looking for? He was actually seemed sincere in his desire that he wanted to learn from Tony. You know, he said he spent so much time knowing Tony as an opponent and not really getting to pick his brain on stuff, that to actually get a chance to be a part of, you know, an organization with Tony was intriguing to him. And I think that it's also interesting that when they announced this kind of change the other day, that they said that KT was kind of informed of this 2 weeks ago, that this was kind of the direction it was headed. And he kept, not only did he keep it quiet, but he also gave Tony some of those names that are on his list of nine that he's going to interview for the GM job. So, it's kind of maybe, I don't know if odd is the right word, or unique in how everyone's kind of gotten along throughout this.
Yeah, well, it's better than the alternative. So maybe other people will learn a little bit from this, even though I doubt. But let's switch gears totally. I saw, you know, Twitter kind of exploded a little bit just from a Diamondbacks perspective when Daniel Hudson appeared in a game for the first time in 799 days, according to my friend Steve Gilbert. two Tommy John surgeries. It was his first appearance since June 26th of 2012, and it seemed to be this highly emotional experience, not just for Hudson, but for anybody who knows him, has covered him, has worked with him, has managed him, has coached him. So I do not know the guy. He sounds like a wonderful person, and it looked like the whole world, the whole baseball world, was pulling for him. So what was that experience like?
That was really kind of a unique deal. You know, here's a guy who was, you know, looked like he was one of the top young pitchers around, and then he blows out his UCL and undergoes his, you know, rehabilitation, and he's a week away. He was in his last minor league appearance when it blows out for a second time and has to undergo the surgery. And there was a time, you know, at least a few days after that second injury where he really was thinking about whether or not he wanted to have the surgery and go through this yet again, because it was just such a crushing blow to be so close and to have to go all the way back to square one. So I think there was a lot of people that just kind of got emotionally invested in seeing that as far as his teammates, because they saw him go through all the rehab. And what was really striking to me was the emotion that was in that clubhouse for it. I mean, Miguel Montero said, you know, normally you go out and kind of greet a relief pitcher when he comes into a game and, you know, make sure everything's on the same page. And he stayed behind the plate, he said, because he was worried if he went out there and looked at Hudson in the eye that he would start crying. So he decided to stay behind the plate. And you just usually don't hear those kind of emotions. So I guess it kind of touched a lot of people, just all he had to go through to get, you know, kind of back up on the mound.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, you like hearing these stories. It'll be really awesome if he is able to continue his major league career. And I guess that's kind of, nobody really knows what's going to happen. I wonder if there's any, you know, just kind of hesitancy or a fear in the back of his mind because of what happened when he was just so close to coming back the first time, that I guess it could happen again. But presumably,
you know,
only time will tell.
In some ways, I was afraid to ask him that question the week or so before he was coming back. I mean, obviously, that was a question I just couldn't bring myself to ask it. But I did ask it the night after his debut. I said, you know, has there been much lately about, and he said, no, not as much as you would think. He's been able to kind of put it past him. And he said, you know, after this first outing, he just kind of felt like if it blows out tomorrow playing catch in the outfield, at least he made it back for one game. At least he proved that he could do that. So certainly he's not looking for it to blow out again, but he seems to be at peace with it with all he's gone through. Now, that could, of course, I guess, change by next year when he's more used to pitching and doesn't want to give that back up. So maybe that fear creeps back in. But at least for right now, he's just thankful to be back.
Yeah, it's a good story to follow, regardless of what happens. So, and we will follow it. So, Steve Gilbert, thank you so much for your time, and we will talk to you next week. I'm joined by my colleague Thomas Harding, who covers the Rockies for MLB.com. This is my favorite 12 minutes of my week. You're thinking, how could that possibly be? The Rockies are going to close in on 90 losses soon, but because I get to spend time with Thomas Harding, who's one of my favorite people. So, Thomas, now that I have buttered you up, let's talk a little bit. Where should we start? Let's talk about Michael Kadire, who he was expected to be activated from the disabled list on Monday, and indeed he was. He missed 2 months with a fractured left shoulder. Walt Weiss says he is going to play, and presumably we'll see him a lot in these next couple of weeks as the season comes to a close. But Kadire is a free agent this winter, so I guess it's important for him to really be seen these last few weeks, to be productive. And do you think that, is there any interest from the Rockies side to bring him back, or how do you think that's going to shake out?
That's going to be an interesting story there, because as the season progressed, they really felt like they needed him there as a veteran leader for this team, and they still think they're going to be good next season. I think that's one thing we have to cover all of our opinions with, is that they believe that if guys come back healthy, they will be a good team next season. And yeah, I could see having him around to have someone to spell Justin Morneau at first base. The problem is Corey Dickerson has hit so well in the absence of Kadire, and if you expect Carlos Gonzalez back, you start running out of places to put a Michael Kadire. Now, if they do trade a Carlos Gonzalez during the offseason, then maybe that's where the room comes back and you go, hey, Michael Kadire, we need you as a veteran type. We know that you've come off injuries this past year. Maybe we can work out something. So that's the thing to watch here. If they re-sign Kadire early or even if he stays on the market, do they trade a Carlos Gonzalez in an attempt to get pitching?
Do you think that, I mean, if you had to, like, sort of rate what this offseason could be, it's not going to be extreme in, as far as, like, rebuilding. It's not going to be, like, idle. It'll be somewhere in between where they realize they've got a pretty good foundation if they're healthy, but they need to figure some things out here and there.
Yeah, they need to figure out the starting pitching. They could use a couple more, although Tyler Matzek has kind of emerged as an answer for them. They re-signed Jorge De La Rosa for the next two seasons, and they're hoping to get back Jolys Chacín healthy. Is that is that enough of a foundation? Also, with the oft-injured Brett Anderson, he pitched very well before he was hurt. Do you have enough starting pitching? Probably not. So you're going to have to add to that. And also, the bullpen really had its problems this year with Rex Brothers not performing up to speed, and Boone Logan coming off injury, and now he's on the 60-day disabled list to finish the season. So those are two areas that have to be improved. How do they do? And I think that's the question of this offseason.
And while we are still talking about the season going on, it's actually been a pretty nice little run that the Rockies have had lately. I mean, we're talking about very small spurts, but recently they won their 11th game in their last 15 home games. They swept the Padres. It was the first three-game home sweep of the season, which is amazing. But there have been some positives, so there has been some good things that have been going on. What have you seen from some of these players?
Well, I think you look at Tyler Matzek and how he has pitched just coming up during the season. That really makes a difference. He was the number one pick in 2009, and it took him a while to get here, but it looks like he could be a solid part of the club going forward. You look at the way Charlie Blackman has hit from the leadoff spot, and also Corey Dickerson. Those guys really could be part of a pretty good offense in the future. Obviously, you need back a Troy Tulowitzki, you need back a Carlos Gonzalez, or someone like that, whether it's him or Michael Kodai, or someone capable of winning the batting title and going to the All-Star game. But some of the other parts are doing pretty well. Michael McHenry, pretty much an afterthought in Pittsburgh after he was hurt last year, has emerged as a decent catcher now. Is he a starter at this level or a guy who can catch in a tandem? We'll see. And Oscar Nolan Arenado, the way he has emerged offensively after a really good year defensively, winning the Gold Glove last year as a rookie. So a lot of good things are happening right now, but I think the fans around here are waiting to see how do you improve this club to where you go into next season believing that it can do well. Other than getting the guys back healthy, how do you do something to make this club more of a contender going into 2015?
And I don't hear much about Walt Weiss. I know we've talked about him before, and obviously you can't possibly pin any of the injury issues or the reason why this team has fallen so deeply down into the standings. But what do you think of him? I mean, just overall, and how is he received by the team sort of publicly? Do you think that he's around for a while?
I think he is because they signed him to a three-year contract last winter. I don't think that they would make a move right now with him unless they cleaned out the front office, which there's no indication they're going to do, and just brought in new people and started all over. What I've seen from Weiss is this. Last year, there was a little bit of a feeling out period. You know, he had worked in the front office, but he was coaching high school baseball, and they hired him out of high school baseball. And there was that feeling out, do I really want to do this? And as that season went on, his competitive drive kicked in, and he did want to do it. I think he's handled it fairly well. I think he's getting more comfortable in the manager's spot. He's able to do some more of the things that he wants with the pitching. I know there's an overall organization policy with pitching, trying to limit pitch counts, but he's doing a little bit more within that, and I think he is one of those guys who believes that if they can get healthy, they have a chance to win a few games. I mean, this is a guy who won his entire career, so you have to like managing in order to stick through what he stuck through these 2 years.
And another interesting guy on his pitching staff, Jorge De La Rosa, who just signed a two-year extension. He would have been a free agent after the season, but he seems to be quite comfortable there at Coors Field. Holds the record for wins, a 759-ish home winning percentage lifetime. So everybody who kind of grouses about going in there and wondering if the humidor is doing any good, and, oh, we can't pitch there, and, oh, this and that, but he doesn't seem to have any problems there. What's he likes it there. What's his magic?
It's nice to see a guy who's come here and pitched and liked it, because what it does is that it takes away some of the excuses from other guys. De La Rosa is able to throw a fastball and a changeup. I know there's a lot of there's a lot of emphasis on contact and ground balls, but he's a high strikeout guy because he uses the changeup. And I think that works here, and maybe they need to incorporate that a little bit more into their training of pitchers or in signing free agents. I recall Sean Estes coming here and having a good year of around 15 wins because he threw a good changeup. So De La Rosa, he succeeded here, and when you talk to him, and I've talked to him many times on and off the record, get along with him quite well, he's a true believer. He really believes that if Jolys Chacín comes back with his shoulder in good shape and there aren't injuries, that this team can go from where it is to a contender and possibly a division champion. Now, there are people who look at that and say, gee, this guy's delusional, but you need guys like that on your team when you're at this stage. And who knows? I mean, he could be right.
You know, that's the thing is, I don't know if people have short-term memory, but it's not like the Rockies have never had success there and have never had good seasons. I mean, we're not that far removed from some crazy runs that they've been on and, you know, a World Series appearance and, you know, major comeback stories. So it's not like the organization is a complete lost cause. I mean, obviously there's a lot that needs to be fixed. But that there's not an attitude that, like, oh, we just can't, you know, we just can't win because where we play and it just never works out.
Right, and they've done it before. And also, when you look at a lot the National League West, as much as you like what the Los Angeles Dodgers have as far as talent is concerned, they never really run away with the division the way their payroll says that they should. The San Francisco Giants, offensively, they still struggle at times, although they're doing pretty well lately. But offensively, they can struggle. They haven't done as well this year as you would have thought they would. I'm not sure that they're even over 500 at home. If not, they're pretty close to 500 at home. So this is a division where you can go from nowhere to somewhere pretty quickly. The Padres have done it in the past. The Diamondbacks have done it. And, yes, the Rockies in 2007 and 2009. And really, they were contending in 2010 until injuries hit them late in the year. So this is not an impossible place to win. And I think locally, after seeing so many rough seasons, you almost have that defeatist attitude. So you need players like a De La Rosa to say, hey, wait a minute, let's get healthy and see where this goes.
Well, it'll be interesting. I just find it fascinating how really average all of the good teams are in baseball.
Yes.
We don't have any teams that are on pace to win 100 games. I mean, the best team being the Angels, I think they're on pace for, you know, 97, 98, which is fantastic, of course. But there does seem to be some parity here, and the good teams are all having their struggles in a lot of ways, too.
Yeah, that's right, and I think with the second wild card, also teams that struggle one year have a chance the next. I mean, I remember, I think it was Bart Giamatti kind of bemoaned some of the changes in baseball when we were talking about wild cards way back then. He was saying it's the NFLization of baseball. But if you look at it, having a whole lot of teams in contention is not a bad thing. I mean, you don't want this sport to become, whether it's the Yankees or the Dodgers or the Red Sox, gee, it's them and everybody else. I think that hurts the sport more than anything. A lot of teams are doing a good job putting together their rosters, spending money in the right way, and that's where we're getting some of the parity from. I don't think it's just total mediocrity. What I think it is that the bottom and the middle of baseball has gotten better, and it's prevented some teams from running away with things.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a bad thing, even though I do think that some teams might press a little bit when they're trying desperately to either hold on to a spot or get into that race. And we might see, you know, I just think that kind of evens things out too a little bit, but who really knows. Thomas, thank you so much for your time, and we will check with you next week. Thanks.
Yes, and just to follow up on what you said, it's better to have had a lead and lost it than to have never had a lead at all.
I would say the Brewers probably wouldn't agree with you right now, but I would. Thank you, T.
That's great.
Thanks for listening to MLB.com Extras, the National League West.